Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ellery Akers. Ellery Akers is a writer, artist, and naturalist living on the Northern California coast. She has published two books of poems, Knocking on the Earth and Practicing the Truth, plus a children's novel entitled Sarah's Waterfall. Akers has won 13 national writing awards, including the Autumn House Poetry Prize and the Poetry International Prize, and her poems have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the American Poetry Review, and The Sun. Hi, Ellery, how are you?
Oh, great. It's good to be here, Jan.
Really, really great to meet you, and happy that you're in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to start with some poems from your new book. By the way, congratulations on your new book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Practicing the Truth by Autumn House Press.
Yes. This first poem is about a word, and the word is please, and it's called The Word That Is a Prayer. One thing you know when you say it, all over the earth, people are saying it with you. A child blurting it out as the seizures take her. A woman reciting it on a cot in a hospital. What if you take a cab through the Tenderloin? At a streetlight, a man in a wool cap, yarn unraveling across his face, knocks at the window. He says, please. By the time you hear what he's saying, the light changes, the cab pulls away, and you don't go back, though you know someone just prayed to you the way you pray. Please, a word so short, it could get lost in the air as it floats up to God like the feather it is, knocking and knocking, and finally falling back to earth as rain, as pellets of ice, soaking a black branch, collecting in drains, leaching into the ground, and you walk in that weather every day. The next poem is about something that we all share, and that is the air that we breathe. And it's called Breathing. I love to feel as if I'm just another body, a breather along with the others. Blackbirds taking sips of air, garter snakes lapping it up with their split tongues, and all those plants that open and close and throw up streamers of oxygen. Maybe that cottonwood that tilts across the creek bed is the very one that just sucked up carbon dioxide and let me breathe. Maybe I should hang a cord around it. Thank you for the next 2 minutes of my life. Maybe some of the air I just swallowed used to be inside the hot larynx of a fox or the bill of an ash-throated flycatcher. Maybe it just coursed past the scales of a lizard, a bluebelly, as he wrapped himself around his mate. Maybe he took an extra breath and let it out, and that's the one I got. Maybe all of us are standing side by side on the earth, our chests moving up and down, every single one of us opening a window, loosening a belt, unzipping a pair of pants to let our bellies swell, while in the pond, a water beetle clips a bubble of air to its shell and comes back up for another. You want sanitary? Go to some other planet. I'm breathing the same air as the drunk southerner, the one who rolls cigarettes with stained yellow thumbs on the bench in the train station, I'm breathing the same air as the Siamese twins at the circus, their heads talking to each other, quarreling about what they want to do with their one pair of hands and their one heart. Tires have run over this air. It's passed right over the stiff hair of jackrabbits and roadkill, drifted through clouds of algae and cumulus, passed through jet props, blades of helicopters, through spiderlings that balloon over the Tetons, through sudden masses of smoke and sulfur, the bleared Buick filled with smoke from the lucky strikes my mother lit one after another. Though as a child, I tried my best not to breathe. I wanted to take only the faintest sips, just enough to keep the sponges inside, all the lung sacs rising and falling. I have never noticed it enough, this colorless stuff I can't see, circulated by fans, pumped into tires, sullenly exploding into bubbles of marsh gas, while the man on the gurney drags it in and out of his lungs until it leaves his corpse and floats past doorknobs and gets trapped in an ice cube dropped into a glass. After all, we're just hanging out here in our sneakers or hooves or talons, gripping a branch or thudding against the sidewalk. As I hold onto my lover and both of us breathe in the smell of wire screens on the windows and the odor of Buckeye, this isn't to say I haven't had trouble breathing. I have. Sometimes I have to pull the car over and roll down the window and take in air. I have to remember I'm an animal. I have to breathe with the other breathers. Even the stars breathe, even the soil, even the sun is breathing up there. All that helium and oxygen, all those gases blowing and shredding into the solar wind.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ellery Akers. She's reading from her new book, Practicing the Truth, published by Autumn House Press. And I want to make sure we mention Michael Sims, who is the head of Autumn House Press and who has done so much for poetry and Pittsburgh and nationally, of course, with this series. So I wanted to ask, what a beautiful poem, you know, both of them. But I love at the end when you say, I'm a breather, I'm an animal. I didn't think it was going there. But I want to ask you about the relationship in your mind between the natural world and your poetry and how that kind of acts when you sit down to write a poem. Do you feel like it's something that you can't even take apart, it's so joined, or do you feel like the natural world is a driving force for your poetry?
I do feel it's a driving force. I'm a naturalist, and I actually work outdoors a lot in California, which is lucky because the weather's so good. But I often take a chair and just go outside. And one of the things I love, and Rilke talks about this a lot, is when I'm outside, I really try to become what I'm writing about. So I try to become the tree or the fox and not impose my human, you know, description on it, but just really try to be there. Sometimes I'll sit for an hour before I even pick up my pen. I just want to be inside that thing before and really honor it and become it. In fact, I do have a poem about that I could read.
Sure, go ahead.
This is a poem I wrote, and I was sitting in the a canyon in the early morning, and the sun came over the rim of the canyon, And I was trying to be with all my might inside this oak tree. And I suddenly felt as I was inside the tree, when the light came over the rim of the canyon, that the tree felt like light was almost like a god. It was quite different the way I felt about life as a writer or anything. Well, light's nice and everything, but the tree, this was amazing, almost religious experience. So I wrote this poem in the voice of the tree. So the tree is speaking in the poem, and it's speaking to a small tree underneath it, kind of giving it advice about being a tree on earth. It's called "The Tree Speaks to Its Seedling About Light, About Birds." Open your hands now. Let them be flat. Let them be glad. Let the halls and cells be opened to receive the king. In the night, wait. In the shade, wait. Also, the moon will come with its stale cold. From time to time, there will come the small bumpers, the birds. They are welcome. They will scrape you. They will brush against you. They will lock you with their talons. They are in a hurry. We are not in a hurry. They will bring sticks and lay them on your arms and sit on them. We think perhaps it is a form of worship. Perhaps the sticks are their king. In the daytime, steer. In the night, store. Remember, always steer towards the king.
Nice. You know, I like how you talk about that, you know, as the tree speaking to the small tree. And I feel, you know, when you talk, I think, oh, she's speaking in poetry, and I feel at home. But it's almost like you're, you know, in poems, there we talk about the turn in the poem or the leaps in the poem, and it's almost like your poems begin after the moment of transformation, and so we're already inside everything.
Hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, well, that's when I'm lucky. Yeah. I mean, I have a very low average in writing, like most writers. I would say I get 1 out of 30 poems. So, you know, the other 29 poems, I just, God bless them.
Well, what do you mean? What do you...
Well, I mean, I'll write, say, 30 poems, and 29 of them are just practice. And I think that's pretty normal, actually. I'm also an artist, and that's my average in art as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the flip side of that is that you know what it takes to write a poem, and that you respect that process.
Well, I was very lucky. I studied with William Stafford, and he said,
"Wow."
Writing, inspiration doesn't lead to writing. Writing leads to inspiration. So he gave me the idea, you know, it's just quantity. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm sure you've heard other poets say, well, I have about 200 poems that I have finished. And in my mind, I always think, can't be that good. <It's> like, but, you know, what you're saying makes a lot more sense to me. Okay. Could you read some more?
Yeah. I come from a violent alcoholic family, and a lot of poems in the book, or some of the poems, deal with that. And so I'm going to read a poem called "The Shouting Match with My Mother," and it's called "The Shouting Match with My Mother at 16. Afterwards, all I knew was I had to get to something large and cold that didn't lie. So I pedaled to the sea, the rusted spokes of my bike creaking with every turn of the wheel. I lifted the broken chain link fence, stepped past logs and beer cans, stripped to my bathing suit, and threw myself into the water. I liked the way the salt stung, and even the way strings of seaweed brushed my feet, though when they looped around me, I kicked them away. With every stroke, I was getting farther from Cliff Break, the house my mother grew up in and was broken in, a girl who could see the years rust and the rust wash in with the scum of foam in that cove where her father fished for her soul as if it was his and hooked it and took it so that I never saw it, only what was left, rage, ash, and bourbon. I swam so far, the lights on the shore looked like gold bees and then like pollen. I wanted the cold and the shock of cold and the salt that crossed back and forth between my teeth. I wanted the sea to slide over my body and rinse the anger out of my hair. But I finally turned back, side-stroked to the beach, and stared, as I always did, at the stars. The only connection I could think of back then, one radiant, cold statement, then millions of miles, nail after nail, each one hammered next to each other, divided by distance, as they should be, like mother and daughter. Well, maybe I'll read one more poem about the sea. This one is about two things I love, and you can see that I really do love the ocean. And the other one is dreams, which I really pay attention to every night. And of course, your listeners probably know that billions of planktonic animals rise to the surface every night, and they drop down the next morning. And this was so much like dreams, I had to really put them in the same poem. And there's a word you may not know, your listeners may not know, it's pyrosoma, and it's a very bioluminescent marine invertebrate. And sometimes fishermen are really bored out there in the ocean, and they kind of lean over and they'll write on these animals with their finger just to see the letters flash because they're so bioluminescent. So this is called What Rises in the Sea at Night Rises in Dreams. Every night, the largest migration of animals in the world rises while we sleep. Arrow worms clear as glass, comb jellies, salps. When the first sting of sun strikes the water, they sink back down. And while I fall asleep, some unlived life floats toward me, or starved parts of myself I pushed down, rise, and scan my eyelids for some kind of recognition before they sink into the steep drop-off of the brain. One night I dreamt I heard a golden tone. A bell rang, but it was a bell made of krill, climbing out of blackness so cold it stank of cold. And in the sea, too, there are bells of jellyfish, rafts of plankton pulsing with light that swim to the surface and rock back and forth. Fishermen know this. They shoot their drift nets at night into a sheen of dinoflagellates. The wake of their boats shines like silver fire. You can read a newspaper if you lean over the bow. One man wrote his signature on a pyrosoma and saw his name flash in letters of fire. And when he went to sleep, he dreamt that deep in the sea, where rain doesn't penetrate or the sound of rain, his name was climbing towards him through the benthic cold, night after night, it kept trying to reach him through the deep speech of the sea.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ellery Akers, reading from her new book, Practicing the Truth. Well, it's almost like when you're reading, you're offering us this place to go, which seems somehow similar to the place the speaker talks about, you know, where the 16-year-old goes, or where the speaker goes for comfort. For example, I love how you start the poem about the mother and the 16-year-old. All I knew is that I had to get to something large and cold that didn't lie.
Mm.
I think that's really brave to start there because it's very original, and it's almost like people save that kind of line for two-thirds of the way down the poem. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to try that. Can you talk about that a little bit, like how you start a poem, and if what I'm saying rings true at all?
Well, you know, I was saying I do work outside a lot, so I do try to be in nature a lot. I also am a very, how shall I say, craft-oriented poet in a way, and I always have a little list with me of like verbs and also the names of things, and I put them on top of my page sometimes before I start and remind myself to use verbs. And of course, Emily Dickinson didn't need to do this because she had such a great brain, but I need to remind myself to use strong language.
Oh, okay. So when you're writing the poem,
I'll actually just look at the top of my list and I'll say, okay, I haven't used a verb. This verb, I'll just drop it in.
So you have a list of verbs.
Yes.
Are these like
strong
verbs?
Anglo-Saxon verbs like blaze or spill drop or sink. I think that was one I used in one of the poems I just read. So I really believe in the power of verbs.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
And so do you revise this list of verbs or add to this list of verbs? I mean,
I just keep adding every time I read.
Uh-huh.
You know, I read Whitman a lot, and I think, oh, I've never used the word spill before. Where have I been, you know?
Wow, I like that. I've never heard anyone say that.
Yeah, it's just, I really love the Bible and Whitman, and partly because they just use lots of verbs. It's very few adjectives. And.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you need to write a guidebook about writing. Like the verb list,
yeah.
The going outside.
I also really use a lot of exercises prompts. I really like those.
Oh, okay.
Because of my feeling is, I think failure is the normal practice of writing. And so I just try to fool myself, this is not going to be a great poem. This is going to be a silly exercise, and mm-hmm. I'm going to use a few verbs, and I have no investment, and that's a good attitude.
Yeah.
You know, that the attitude that often people start writing with, I'm going to go into the castle of art in the front door, and I'm going to write a great poem. And this is just the kiss of death. You know, you want to go back in the castle, in the kitchen, and peel potatoes. That's the right attitude, you know.
Or in the backyard.
Or the backyard. Yeah. And be very humble and approach it that way.
Okay. Could you read more?
Yeah. Here's a poem I wrote after a death, and it's about that period after a death when you can't feel the presence of the dead person at all. It's almost like there's a wall, and usually that changes, but it's called The Dead. The dead can't hear us when we talk. There isn't air thin enough for our words, solid as they are, to get through that sieve light makes. Static of light, static of salt. And we can't hear them either. Sometimes they try to speak to us, but when they open their mouths, light comes out. They're fishermen who have stepped out of their oilskins and dropped off the side of the boat, naked, into the sea. It's not that they can't hear our hoarse breath. They can. But our grief sounds to them like the barking of seals far off. They can't remember what it means, though they know they used to know. So I'm going to read another poem. I'm an environmentalist, obviously, and this is about the death of the starfish on the West Coast. And millions of starfish are dying because of a virus, they think, and probably because of climate change. And they get covered with lesions. So this one is called Lesions. Whenever a species gets stubbed out like this, I feel the border of our lives is fraying. The map of the sea yanked blank in one corner, becoming a pocket of nothing, as in, where do you keep your nothing? Here. Sometimes I think we're holding the diameter of the earth in our hands, an elastic band stretched tight, and we're living in the years before it snaps back and tosses animals and trees and us away. Maybe we should write a letter to those people of the future. Here is the earth. Love it for us. It's hard to believe, but we loved it too. This is a very short poem about the consolations of nature. I think this is something that happens to everyone in nature. And I often lie around at night, and this is a poem about lying on a footbridge and looking at the sky. I lay on a footbridge over a stream. Because the night scoured me, took my little bundle of suffering, filled me with clean black cold, sorrel and flux, smell of creosote, all the pores of leaves closed, but I was open, soaked by the dark, shocked by the stars, their astringent perfume.
It's the poetry of Ellery Akers. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.